This committee for May 5th, Tuesday. I can't believe it's May already. Time flies when you're having fun, doesn't it, gentlemen?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And with that, we have a series of public hearings today and possible work sessions, and we'll start with a public hearing on HJR 16, and I see that Representative Cowan is here. I'd like to invite her up, and I know that Senator Cruz wanted to be here. Okay. And Senator Berger's requested to carry the bill. Okay. Is this Jack Barth with you?
Jack Great. Is with me, yes.
Thank you. Welcome, Representative. Good to see you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's good to be here in your committee.
We hope to have a few more members here. We have a little problem with lateness over in the Senate.
That's all right. I'm supposed to be in another room at the same moment in time, too, so that's the way it goes. For the record, I am Jean Cowan. I'm the state representative from House District 10. Here to talk to you today about House Joint Resolution 16. And I think that they're probably sharing with you a copy of the letter from the Quinnebay Economic Foundation, be lovingly referred to as YBEEF. That's a group in my neck of the woods in Newport. And I think it's significant their support for this particular effort. This is a group that's been around since 1981. It's a high-powered group of individuals in our community. If you look at some of the signatures on the back, you can see that they range through a pretty broad scope of the entities that they represent in Lincoln County. David Bigelow, the president of YBEEF, didn't mention that he's also the CEO of the local hospital. So these are folks who care a great deal about the economic well-being in our community. The situation that we're faced with today is that our much-loved research vessel, Wacoma, has been around for a long time, shepherding folks out to the ocean to do their research, and that it's sort of like my friends with me won't appreciate me calling it a taxi, but you know we attract researchers from all over the world that come and take advantage of this vessel to go out and do their necessary research. And sadly, our beloved Wacoma is nearing the end of its life and is going to need to be retired. It's been operated by Oregon State University for 30 years. But that scientific research needs to continue offshore. And there is a replacement vessel being made available and a competitive process to access that vessel. The state of Oregon is the only state that up to this point has not put anything, not one cent, into that operational effort. And in order to be competitive in the next go-round, we really need to show some indication that the state is supportive of this economic venture. And we have to stop and think. The vessel's activities are supported by $3.5 million, and then when you roll that up into the money that's reinvested, probably easily $12 million into our community. So the loss of this vessel would be very significant to our community and also to the loss of the scientists that it attracts. What we are asking in this resolution is an opportunity, pardon me, to recognize the state's responsibility in securing the services of such a research vessel and our best intent, and I emphasize that, to support the operation of a new Oceans Class research vessel to the tune of $500,000 annually beginning in 2014. So there are no resources being asked in the 2009-11 biennium. I understand what would happen if I asked for money this biennium. But it is critical that we do this now because the proposal needs to go in now, and in order to be competitive in that proposal, we need to indicate that the state cares and is willing to put some effort into this in the future. I'm also a realist, and I understand we can't firmly obligate a future legislature to that particular amount, but to voice our intent is important. This measure passed the House, by the way, 60-0. Highly supported all the way through the process, and we bring it now to you.
Great. Thank you, Representative. Did you want to add anything?
Yes, please. I'm Jack Barth. I'm a professor of oceanography at Oregon State University, and I'm here on behalf of Dean Mark Abbott, who unfortunately fell ill. I just want to reiterate what Representative Cowan was saying about, first of all, how Oregon's ocean is so fundamental to our heritage. And as she pointed out, we've been spending many years, 30 years on the RV Wacoma, going to sea, making fundamental discoveries, and using that scientific understanding to work with the stakeholders and the state to better manage those ocean resources. So we're coming to the end of that 30-year life of Wacoma, and it's, as was pointed out, there's a request for proposals coming out. It'll be out this fall. For us to compete, we need to have a state contribution. We can't even get involved if we don't show some state input. As Representative also pointed out, many other scientists come to this area and come to the Pacific Northwest to study our ocean. I've got a few handouts here, including the remarks I'm making now. If you could take a look at those. One of those is the there's three here. One of those is a quick facts about the Wacoma. And
could we just get you maybe move the mic one way or the other? For whatever reason, we're getting
feedback. We're getting the reverb from both
from
the mics together. Yeah.
How's that?
That's better.
A little bit better.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, those handouts make them around. It's just some quick facts about the Wacoma, and we've discovered some very fundamental things like hydrothermal vents. You know, we've all seen these black smokers coming out of the bottom of the ocean. OSU scientists made that discovery, and Wacoma made it possible. You've heard about these low-oxygen dead zones and how they are influenced by climate change. Those are fundamental, important issues that we'll be able to address with this with the vessel. As was also mentioned, there's $3.5 million that come in to support the annual operations. That's multiplied by at least a factor of 8, providing many more jobs for the local area. We anticipate the new vessel will have an operating budget of about $5 million per year. So taking that multiplier, it would be about $40 million per year benefit. There's going to be two of these, one on the East Coast and one on the West Coast. So we've competition is going to be very stiff for that West Coast vessel, and we need to have our put our best foot forward. Without the vessel, we lose that ability to understand oceanic processes and how they affect the use of ocean resources. As you all know, there's fishermen, tourists, and increasingly in the future, potential energy sources from the ocean. We've got to have the scientific understanding to address those correctly. As Representative Cowan pointed out, Oregon is the only coastal state that does not put in any money to maintaining or operating the research vessel. And Wacoma really is a symbol of Oregon as an ocean state. As I travel around the country and the world, people know about the Wacoma, and they know about the great research in the state of Oregon. We'll be required to show that commitment in our proposal process. That's why we're asking you now and not in 2014. We've got to say in that proposal that this is a high priority for the state and that we want to be a serious contender. We're about to embark on a very major field program. Some of you may have heard me talk about that. It's an ocean observing system to look at our ocean offshore. It's hundreds of millions of dollars from the federal government. We want to be front and center with our research vessel to install and operate that system. We can't afford to sit on the sidelines on this one. So just to go back to the quick facts now that you have it in your hand, it lists a number of scientific discoveries. On the back are just some quick facts about the economic benefit. And I just want to point out on the front that that picture of the guys with the wave coming over the side, that's me on the left holding on for dear life, trying to put out that instrument. So Wacoma is very dear to us. And I just close with a quote from perhaps the most famous physical oceanographer of the last couple decades, Henry Stommel, who actually discovered how the Gulf Stream worked. And he says, a computer looks pretty impressive on a college campus, but a well-equipped oceanographic vessel is a grander sight and makes a person want to work at sea. We've got to have access to the sea. We can't do this just with computer models. So I respectfully ask for your support of the House Joint Resolution 16. Thank you for your time.
Great. Thank you. Any questions? Senator Boquist?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah. Who are the competing universities most likely?
Madam Chair and Senator Boquist, I can tell you that it's Scripps Institution of Oceanography, San Diego, California.
It's going to be tough competition.
Our argument will be that, as I told you, most of the really compelling scientific questions are off our coast. Mm-hmm. And if they win, they'll be running a ferry service from San Diego up to here. So we want to have a vessel we can work off our shores.
And there's nobody in Washington?
Washington is actually a supporter of our effort because mm-hmm. we in turn supported them getting the RV Thomas Thompson about 10 years ago. So we kind of have a joint agreement there.
And what happens to the existing boat? I mean, does it go to get dismantled, or is it sold to another country?
Exactly. It's usually sold for future use, often in another country.
And there's no way to extend the life of this? Is
we're doing
much
that now.
Expired.
We're past the design life. Some people call it using chewing gum and wires to hold it together. But we're in our first 5-year extension.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. Thank you both very much. And if you stick around, we'll open up a work session. Would anybody else like to? I see that Representative Roblin, I don't know if you wanted to add a few words, or anybody else like to comment on this resolution?
Were they on the list?
No, but he's a coastal representative.
If they're not on the list, Madam Chair, he's here for some other reason.
Thank you.
For the record, I'm Representative Arnie Roblin from House District 9, and I do appreciate the concerns that other members of your committee have. But I do, as a coastal caucus member, this was a big bill. It came to all of us. We all supported it. And I think, for me, one of the issues that keeps coming up over and over and over again is how do we get scientific research done off our coast so we know more about the questions that we have. And this is one of those ways where we continue to make sure there are advances. And I really do appreciate those inland people who have
care about ocean resources.
I vote yes to go forward, right?
Yeah. That's right. That's why I care about you so much.
And, Representative, you can stay up there because you're up for the next one. So with that, we will close the public hearing on HGR 16. Thank you very much for coming up. We'll open up a work session.
I would, Madam Chair, I'd move HJR 16 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Atkinson moves HJR 16 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. And is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the motion passes, and Senator Berger has requested to carry the bill, so we will ask her to carry that. So with that, we will close the work session on HJR 16. Thank you, Representative. And we will open up a public hearing on our next bill, House Bill 2583. Beth?
House Bill 2583 prohibits launching of boat into the waters of the state if the boat has any visible aquatic species that are detrimental to wildlife on its exterior hull, other exterior or interior parts of the boat, including the bilge, or the trailer used to transport the boat. There is a dash to amendment in front of you and in the back of the room also for your consideration.
Okay, and I see Representative Witt is also here on this bill. So, Representative Witt, would you like to come up as well? Welcome, gentlemen. Thank you for bringing us this bill, and I'm sure you want to share some thoughts with us.
I would. Again, for the record, Arnie Roblin, State Representative, House District 9. You see a bill that is very dear to my heart. It's one that I introduced the last session, and it created a big furor that we were going to fine people for putting their boats in. And so everybody got upset, and it went away quietly. So this session, the same people who were upset about it being introduced last time had talked to me about reintroducing it, because probably a month after the first introduction and the other bill had died, we had the opportunity for our state police to find two vehicles being towed through our state that appeared to have zebra mussels on their hull, and they had no authority to stop, no authority to keep them from launching in our waters. It turned out when they were stopped that they were on their way to Washington, which does have some cleaning ability, so they escorted them to the border and thanked them for leaving without putting this boat in the water. And they cleaned it, apparently, in Washington, which was required. And it is that was one of the events. There's been a couple other events where we have suspected that some of these aquatic creatures have visited our state and gone on and haven't invaded. We have used, as the state of Oregon, the other states around us as our protective buffer. And for many years, California, Washington, Idaho, Nevada did not have any of these creatures in them. The reality is that California now does have quagga mussels, Nevada also. So they are on our steps, and we need to make sure that we have available to us the ability to create a stop before it gets into our waters. There has not been a successful eradication of these mussels in any open waterway. There was apparently one successful cleaning of a water body, which happened to be an old quarry where they dumped all the chemicals they could until everything died, and they actually killed them. But it's the only place that I've heard of having any success. And it had no way in or out for the water, so they could do what they wanted with it. But once it gets in the system, they generate very, very quickly. So what the bill does is basically say you have to clean your boat before you put it in a body of water. The Dash 2 amendments, we had a lot of conversations with lots of people, including Fish and Wildlife and Agriculture. And the bill... and we sent it over because we were concerned about how to get the wording right and keep working on our amendment, and we needed to get it over here. But when it talks about that is determined to be wildlife, I say, the boat has any visible aquatic species that is detrimental to wildlife in the state on its exterior hull. There was no way to define what those were, so people didn't know what they had to clean off or not clean off.
Are you talking about on the original
bill? On the original bill, okay. The one that you have.
Line 1516.
Line 16. Yeah, actually, I think it starts, 15.
Yeah, and 12 through, okay.
So what we did is we started having conversations about how do we clean that up, and what we finally came to was that currently you'll see these little placards around that Fish and Wildlife are putting about to look for these kind of creatures, and there's also some placards on some invasive plants that agriculture, they've identified them, and so the Dash 2s basically say aquatic invasive species mean any aquatic life or marine life determined by the Fish and Wildlife Commission by rule to be invasive, or any aquatic noxious weed determined by the State Department of Agriculture to be invasive. So it clarifies that definition so that that's where you know to go and find out. That's who's training our state police right now to look for it. And then it goes on to talk about some other things, and at the very end it says, the State Fish and Wildlife Commission, in consultation with the State Department of Agriculture, by rule may allow the presence of certain aquatic invasive species on or within a boat for activities including but not limited to hunting and photography. When the invasive thing is already there, say a grass or whatever, and someone wants to go out and put a blind, put their boat and put Scotch broom or something on it, because that's what's around the area so they can blend in and take pictures or do hunting, we wanted to make sure that we didn't inadvertently make them a criminal because they pulled out a weed that was already there to cover their boat with, and it turns out that it was one of the ones that was invasive, because pulling it out was probably a good thing to do, not a bad thing. Putting it on their boat gave them the cover that they could do for fishing and other kinds of stuff. So that was the reason for the amendments. And I'm glad to answer any questions about this.
I have a question about the amendment, but I was thinking we should let Representative Witt go first, who might want to add a few things before we start peppering you with questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brad Witt, State Representative, House District 31. Good afternoon to you and the committee. Thank you for this opportunity. I'm here today in support of House Bill 2583 and would like to compliment and thank Representative Roblin for his leadership on this issue. As someone whose district is known as the River District, I can assure you that we pay considerable attention to trying to avoid the introduction of additional aquatic invasive species. In the lower Columbia River, we've already seen what various aquatic vegetation introductions have done in terms of species like Japanese knotweed and purple light loosestrife and others. They have literally taken over. And are very concerned at this point should we have the great misfortune of an introduction of some aquatic animal species such as zebra, quagga mussels, that our state would be in for some environmental devastation, the likes of which, well, you have to go to the Great Lakes states, frankly, to see just how bad it is. And millions and millions and millions of dollars are spent trying to protect marine equipment and the likes, and virtually impossible to get rid of these species once they're introduced. So a critically important bill for the preservation of our marine habitats throughout the state.
I was mentioning last week that I rewatched the OPB invasive species special, which, if you haven't seen it, colleagues, that especially talking about how the, was it quagga or zebra mussels that was
originally zebra
into Lake Mead?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
From one boat.
Right.
That was in Great Lakes.
I think they're quaggas, actually.
Was that quaggas?
Yes.
One boat, Mark, quaggas. One boat that was in the Great Lakes, and they trailered it back to Lake Mead and then spread it to Lake Mead. It's amazing. But the question that I had regarding the Dash 2s, when I was reading these, noticed that the State Marine Board was taken out of the bill. And the question we had about is notification. You know, how will boat owners be notified? And I understand why Fish and Game, or Fish and Wildlife and Department of Ag was put in there, because they're doing the rulemaking. But lines 17 and 18, it's 5 through 18 are deleted. So what role, I'm assuming that the Marine Board is one who has to educate the
Yeah, the Marine Board is actually the people who came and got this bill to me. I would love to keep them in. I think that the issue, the Marine Board doesn't identify the critters that we're talking about. It's these other two agencies that do that. So that was why we put it in. It was not to take them out. They do a lot of the notification. They will continue to do the notification. The issue was they aren't the plant experts, nor are they the invasive experts to get in the information. Once that information is done, the Marine Board is one of the great opportunities that we have to get the information out.
So and can I would you work with my committee staff to make sure
make sure
that
the Marine Board's in there. I have no problem with that, because there's no intention in them, and I didn't believe that the amendments would actually take them out in the sense that they would still do their job, which is to inform people.
It might have been inadvertent, but it does look like they are taken out.
Okay.
So That was the only question I had. Any other
I have
questions?
No problem with that.
Mr. Manager, I just had the same exact question.
Yeah, I missed that entirely.
Manager, they're just, people will go to the Internet and look and say, Marine Board, I'm coming to Oregon, and they're not going to go look at the Department of Agriculture page and say, well, gee, can I bring my boat? Can
I bring the and you can talk to the Marine Board. But I agree. We need to make it explicit. So
we'll,
I will work with them to make that happen.
So if you can work with Beth, and we'll get that added before we can move on this bill. Any other questions before we bring up the last? We have some folks who'd like to testify. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I know that you're not going too far, because you're testifying on some other bills, too. Thank you. We have Tom Wolfe, is it Rudy Henry, and Mark Sitzma. Would you all come up? You guys look like you're on all of these bills, but what I'm going to do is, for the next two bills, I'll open up two public hearings. For this one, it's just going to be 2583.
Okay.
If you can limit your comments to that, and Tom, why don't you get started?
Chair Dingfelder, committee members, my name is Tom Wolfe, the executive director of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. We support this bill. We admire Representative Roblin's initiative in continuing to do it this year. And as he stated, it's a much better atmosphere for doing something about invasives this session. Part of what the environmental community and Trout Unlimited is trying to do is do a lot to combat invasives. We are big supporters of a border station bill that will hopefully make it to your committee also, but we think this is a great step here, because quagga mussels and zebra mussels and other aquatic invasives are very bad for the ecosystems. If they get into systems, they will literally coat the streams and not allow any macroinvertebrates to exist, and literally cause the vertebrates like trout and other fish to die of starvation and have to migrate to someplace where they aren't found. They're a tremendous have a tremendous impact on the ecosystem. Unfortunately, you know, we've allowed a lot of terrestrial invasives to come into the state, such as Japanese knotweed, Scotch broom, and others, and we're spending millions of dollars trying to restore areas that they're in right now. The best way we can deal with invasives is not to allow them in the state in the first place, so this is a great bill, and we support it.
Great. Thank you.
Hello, thank you. Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee, my name is Randy Henry, Operations Policy Analyst with the Oregon State Marine Board. I'm here today because I want to support House Bill 2583 and answer any questions you may have. The handout that you're getting has some photos in it and some other documentation that we can look at to help illustrate the issue. First, I want to assure you that there is a lot of energy being focused on outreach, education, and prevention of invasive species, aquatic invasive species within the state of Oregon. The Oregon State Marine Board has worked closely with other state and federal agencies and through the Oregon Invasive Species Council, on which we sit on the board, and other organizations. We've been a leading voice in education and outreach to Oregon boaters. Our message is simple and very clear: never launch a dirty boat. It's a message that we proclaim through our sustainable boating campaign, through news releases, at our boat and sports shows and displays, and numerous publications. Our goal is really simple. We want every boater to take an active role in preventing the spread of invasive aquatic plants and animals into Oregon's waterways. That's important because each time one of these organisms is spread, we lose something very important. And what we lose is healthy waterways. Eurasian water milfoil, Brazilian elodea, and other aquatic plants are already well established in the coastal, in some coastal lakes and in the Mid-Valley, and they're already and they directly impact boating, either by clogging up the waterways or by competing with natural habitats that affect the productivity of fish species. Milfoil is even now in East Lake and Polina Lakes and threatens Crane Prairie, Wickiup Reservoir, and some of the other prime trap fisheries of Central Oregon. Those are fisheries that I've grown up with and dearly love. These weeds directly impact fish populations by converting the habitats to a thick, non-productive monoculture. About 65% of Oregon's boaters own their boats primarily for fishing. So when these fisheries are damaged, boating declines and we lose another piece of our precious quality of life. Certainly, there's also the concern about quagga and zebra mussels, which you're hearing a great deal about, and this bill would give us an excellent tool in preventing those spread. House Bill 2583 is one of several bills designed to prevent the spread of invasive species. This particular bill is simple in scope. It backs up our Never Launch a Dirty Boat campaign with an enforceable statute. The bill should have several amendments integrated, which most are in the Dash 2 amendment. But there's another one that I'll explain briefly, and I think its absence is an oversight, hopefully. These must be incorporated, and if incorporated, they will help create a law that balances an important enforcement need with the boater's ability to easily comply. And that's really important. We don't want to put a law out there that's so onerous that boaters simply can't comply. That's going to be non-productive. First, the definition of aquatic invasive species should be consistent with other ODFW statutes, and the definition in the Dash 2 is consistent with that. Second is a fine point, and it's sort of a logic issue, so if you have any questions, I'll try to help you through what our thinking is. The language should say that any visible aquatic species on the hull or motor system or propulsion system is prohibited at launch. Not just invasive species, but any visible species. And the reason we make that distinction is because this bill doesn't come with money to fund extensive training for law enforcement. There's no way we're going to be hiring biologically trained or specially trained enforcement officers to go to a boat that's got seaweed on it and say, well, this one appears to be a native milfoil and this one appears to be a non-native, so this boat needs to not go in the water. The goal is to create a simple enforcement tool to prevent a boat from being launched. It's not that hard to clean a boat. It's not that hard to physically remove the weeds from a boat. So our desire would be to make it very simple and clear. Don't launch a dirty boat. Make sure there's no visible aquatic vegetation, good, bad, or indifferent, on your boat when you launch it. For the most part, this will be pretty easy. There will be some situations where boaters will have to adapt. That's probably the price of living in such a mobile boating environment as we do. Second, it should be stated that any visible aquatic species, whoops.
And are you Page do two. You have are you talking about the Dash 2s? Do you have a copy of the Dash
2s? The Dash 2s capture all of these changes, except that the word invasive is still in 2A. So the 2A of the Dash 2 amendment reads,
okay, so
the boat has any visible aquatic invasive species. And it would be my recommendation that invasive comes out of that. There's already statutes about that seek to prevent the transport of invasive species. This one gives enforcement a tool at the ramp to say, I can't tell if that's invasive or not. Clean your boat.
Okay.
That's the goal there. It does seem it's definitely an aggressive step, but I think it's one that we're at the stage now we need to take. Third, another good example, just to quickly illustrate why that's important. Back in February, I was notified by our port of entry in Ashland that a commercially hauled vessel with shellfish and other aquatic sea life on the hull was at the way station. We've done training, ODFW and myself, Marine Board, have done training at all of the ports of entry in the state to help gear them up to identify a potential problem. And when they see those, they call either Rick Boatner with ODFW or myself. And in this situation, there was unidentified shellfish on the boat. It allegedly came from saltwater, but it came from Southern California, and that's a big concern. We had no enforcement mechanism to hold that boat, so the boat was certified and sent on up the highway on I-5. We were able to contact Oregon State Police. They were able to pull the boat over and take some pictures. But they also determined through training that we've done with Oregon State Police that there were no zebra or quagga mussels, so the boat was released. But we were able to forward pictures of those organisms to a former student of Mark Sitzma, who was able to look at those, and because of his expertise, he was able to name five or six different organisms that appeared to potentially still have some life in them. If that, they probably weren't listed as invasive species. If they had been launching in Yaquina Bay or something like that, we could have had a potential problem. That's a good example of why we need a more general law. Simply require them to clean their boat before launching, and those sorts of potential issues are resolved. Third, it should be clear that aquatic invasive species are prohibited within the hull. And the word invasive species is listed there because we don't want to prohibit people from having Dungeness crab in their boat. And if we just said aquatic species, then we'd be impacting those sorts of things. So that's the reason, logically, why invasive is there, but it's not in the previous statement. One last point is that the rule focuses on the point of launch, not retrieval or transport. Again, this is necessary because Oregon has over 1,000 developed boat launches, and only a handful of these have washdown facilities. It would cost literally tens of millions of dollars to retrofit even the most popular of these access sites with wash facilities. And for remote locations, the requirement would probably be completely unfeasible. It's perfectly acceptable to pull your boat out of a waterway if there's weeds left on it, take it home, park it on your lawn or on a permeable gravel surface away from storm drains or ditches or the such, and clean it and remove the vegetation there. That's perfectly acceptable. Or you can find your local self-serve car wash. So it appears that all the changes are there except the one word invasive, which we've covered. House Bill 2583, with these amendments, has been vetted through the Bass Federation, Oregon Hunters Association, other key organizations, Oregon Trout. We've worked closely with Oregon State Police to ensure that the language is useful and appropriate. After years of looking at this problem, this offers a tool that is common in other states and sorely missing in Oregon. It's one of the key tools we can use to prevent continued infestations in our waterways. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to try to answer them.
I just have a quick one about the dash twos, because do we need to have you in here? Are you ready? It sounds like you're already doing the outreach and education. So I don't know if it's through existing rule or do you need statutory authority. You already have that. I don't have the statute right in front of me.
Excellent point, Chair Dingfelder. We're already highly involved in this, and we've been involved for 5 or 6 years. We've worked with Senator Roblin and Representative Roblin in the past to develop the language and bring this to the point. We have incorporated this message and information in our voter education requirements. It's on our website. We work very closely with Department of Fish and Wildlife. We have current standing members on the Oregon Invasive Species Council. And we really consider ourselves the mouthpiece to Oregon's voters, but we do rely on on ODFW and the Department of Ag's biological expertise. So that continued partnership will certainly continue. Absolutely.
Okay, great. Well, if you could work with Representative Roblin and my committee staff, Beth, just to make sure that we're all on the same page with the dash twos, that would be great.
Okay, certainly.
Any other questions for the Marine Board? Yes, Senator Boquist.
Just a comment, Madam Chair. I'd be obviously more comfortable. I know they all have a love fest between themselves, but that might not be in 3 years. I'd be more comfortable
with
if
the amendment
in there actually has some sort of language that says that people go to the Marine Board website and that's where they find this information. So
that's fine.
Okay. Yeah, no problem with that. Okay. Any other questions? All right. Mark?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mark Sitzma. I'm the immediate past chair of the Oregon Invasive Species Council, and I'm director of the Center for Lakes and Reservoirs at Portland State University that is charged with implementing the state's Aquatic Invasive Species Management Plan. And I'm just here to voice my support and the council's support for this bill and the amendments that Randy and Senator Dingfelder have recommended to the Dash 2. I think this critical bill to prevent introductions of invasive species is really, I can't see any real reason why somebody should be hauling weeds around on their boats, between boats. That's really the primary method of dispersal of these invasive species in the state, and I think this bill would go a long ways towards preventing that. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Sitzma? All right. Thank you, gentlemen. And I know you'll be back up here shortly. Anybody else that would like to testify on House Bill 2583? Okay, with that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2583. It sounds like we just have a little work to do on the amendment, on a new amendment, and then that'll be coming back to the committee. Next, I'm going to open up two public hearings, and I'm going to ask Representative Roblin and Representative Witt to come up for both of these. I'll open up a public hearing in House Bill 2714 and a public hearing in House Bill 2625. And Beth will tell us about both of these.
Madam Chair and committee members, House Bill 2714A creates the Shipping Transport of Aquatic Invasive Species Task Force, directs the task force in consultation with the Invasive Species Council to submit a report to the interim legislature. The House Bill 2625 authorizes the Department of Environmental Quality to board and inspect vessels regulated under ballast water statutes and collect samples of ballast water to verify compliance.
Okay, great, thank you. So whoever wants to, why don't we start with 2714 and then we can go to 2625, or if you want to testify on both.
I will testify to 2714 and I will leave the next one to Representative Witt. We worked very hard to put together a bill that wasn't going to cost any money, and it is a bill that does have a continuation of a group in which actually Representative Witt was a member of, so he could actually talk to this bill as well. Our hope here is to make sure that we are consistent with the states of Washington and California with regard to discharging of ballast water. The current set of affairs is that Oregon's fines and other conditions on ballast water discharge are very different and much cheaper than our surrounding states, which leads to the possibility, and we don't believe it has happened, but the possibility that if they were coming to a port in Washington and realized that they needed to discharge their ballast, it would be much easier to go across the Columbia River to the other side, the Oregon side, and discharge their ballast water there, even though they may have a fine, because the fine would be much less than maybe going back out to sea and doing what they should have done before. And so what this bill is designed to do is to set up our task force, and there are two representatives, a senator and a representative, that are appointed, though I will tell you that if they choose to do this, they get no per diem and they get no travel expenses. It will be on their own dime because we wanted to make this an inexpensive committee assignment, and there are people who are willing to volunteer to do so. But it allows us and our DQ to make the appropriate rules and put them in place so that we stay in touch with the other states around us, so that as we change these things over time, as we learn more about different techniques that can be used to clean bilges and make sure that we don't have a problem with discharge, that we're in the position to advance those very quickly. But the first thing we need to do is at least get up to standards that we are today. So that's pretty much it. It allows the Environmental Quality Commission to set those standards with the help of this commissioner group.
Great. Thank you. Any questions for the representative on this specific bill? Okay. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, again, State Representative Brad Witt, House District 31, appearing in support of House Bill 2625. this bill is an attempt to close a loophole that was left over from a bill that then-Senator Avakian and I sponsored in the 2007 legislature, which banned the dumping of ballast water in the Columbia River. It's a very important bill, again, intended to help regulate the or stop the spread of aquatic invasives. Unfortunately, that piece of legislation did not grant DEQ authority to board vessels in order to be able to monitor the ban. And so, quite simply, House Bill 2625 grants that authority to both board and inspect the vessels to make sure that ballast water dumping is not occurring within our state's waters.
Okay. And just a clarification, the Coast Guard can already do that on outside the territorial sea, is that correct?
That's correct.
So this is just within Oregon's territorial sea. Okay. Questions on this? Senator Boquist, sorry, digressing.
I'm just curious, and we got like three or four from the same group of reps. You guys have a fish fry and come up with all these things? That all these at the same time.
We have a coastal caucus. We have a lot of conversations.
You obviously have more time in the House.
Any questions? Okay. All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen. And actually, I will like to call up, from DEQ, we have Palmer Mason and Ryan, am I saying that right? Off? Both from the DEQ. And you're testifying on both House Bill 2714 and 2625, correct? Why don't you get started,
okay.
Palmer?
For the record, my name is Palmer Mason with the Department of Environmental Quality. I'm here with Ryan Hoof, who is the program manager for DEQ's ballast water program. And, yes, we're here to testify in support on both House Bill 2714 and House Bill 2625. So I'm going to end my remarks there and let Ryan say a few brief words about both bills.
Okay.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Ryan Hoof, a staff with the Department of Environmental Quality. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, as the ballast water project manager for the state, I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2714 as amended. This bill specifically addresses two recommendations from the 2008 task force, as identified in the report to the legislature that was completed in October. First, it provides for continuation of the task force so that it may continue to monitor various emerging issues that have important implications for how we can further enhance our ability to reduce the introduction of potential invasive species into state waters from commercial-related activities. Second, it would allow the Environmental Quality Commission to adopt by rule additional regulatory measures that will further enhance our ability to reduce the risk from these shipping operations. Specifically, the bill would authorize rulemaking that could establish, would establish ballast water discharge standards that would facilitate regulatory consistency with our neighboring states, something that has been identified as something very important to our maritime industry stakeholders. Secondly, this rulemaking would allow DEQ to implement alternative ballast water management strategies under emergency situations when and if it is determined that a vessel is preparing to discharge unmanaged ballast water that we deem to be high risk. These rulemaking recommendations have been packaged into a single bill with the task force continuation, primarily because we would like to use that task force to play a critical role in the rulemaking development process. We continue to seek participation from a breadth of stakeholders during the task force proceedings, and would use this as a forum for seeking consensus on the rulemaking initiatives. It's important to note that this bill does not require additional fiscal resources for DEQ. Our current ballast water program consists of one FTE, namely me, dedicated to monitoring vessel arrivals, monitoring the reporting and ballast discharge compliance, outreach with various stakeholders, and participating in regional policy coordination with our neighboring states. In 2008, I also provided coordination and staff support to the 2008 task force and would continue to do so with the passage of this bill. We anticipate that the recommended rulemaking proposed in House Bill 2714 could be carried out with existing staff resources. However, if the rulemaking, I should say, this rulemaking is discretionary for DEQ, and if we determine that the rulemaking becomes more complex than we anticipate, we may postpone the rulemaking on some or all of the proposed topics until we have sufficient staff resources to be able to do so. In conclusion, I'd like to encourage your support of this bill as it will enhance our ability to prevent future introductions of non-native species that could otherwise result in detrimental ecological and or economic harm to our state's waters. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
On to the next one.
Thank you. Yeah, yeah. Right. You could.
And my comments for House Bill 2625 are very similar in terms of support as they currently stand. This will simply just provide legal clarity for us to do the work that we've started doing, but anticipate to continue to do so. There have been no reported problems in terms of boarding vessels at this point, but as we continue and to increase some activities such as ballast water sampling, we want to make sure that we have clear legal authority for doing so in case it's ever challenged. And that's the basis for House Bill 2625.
And I just had a question on that. Do you actually have staff to do this testing? Or do
I do.
Or are they required to submit samples to the state? I mean, do you actually go on board and do the testing?
Well, currently we're trying to develop more robust verification tools. The ability to go on and verify that the proper management practices have been performed range from very simply taking a little water sample and an eyedropper and testing its salinity. That can be, depending on the voyage characteristics of a vessel, it can be a strong enough tool for compliance and enforcement purposes. But on some voyages, such as coming from a saltwater port to another saltwater port, just using salinity to verify whether or not they did the mid-ocean exchange or flushing of the tanks leaves lots of room for challenges and uncertainty. So we're developing some more robust tools, which we haven't started to use yet, that involve a little more timely sampling practices and perhaps some more technical support, but we haven't gone down that path yet.
And this is out of the purview of, say, the Port of Portland. I'm just curious if they do any type of sampling requirements. I mean, they're going in their docking stations a lot of times, you know, unloading, going back out. So the port is not involved in any of those.
They've been very supportive. They participate on our task force, and they're very supportive of the work that we do and recognize that they could be liable if aquatic invasive species are found near the berth of their activities out at the Port of Portland. But they do not have, their staff are not participating in sampling actually on the vessel in terms of looking in their ballast water tanks like we are doing or like we'd like to be doing even more so.
All right. Thank you. Questions? Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
He's the inquisitive one down there.
Well, I'm reading the regulation here for our deal.
They're doing due diligence for the committee.
So my question is, I mean, the department may verify compliance with the ORSs we're amending here through the Coast Guard and national associations and National Ballast Information Clearing House and so on and so forth. And you're an office of one, so I'm a follow-up to Senator Dingfelder's question here. I mean, who's going to do the boarding and inspecting, and are we creating a ballast water police now? Are we going to expand the department by fee? Or I understand the intent. I'm just trying to figure out where we seem to have the same authority already, but...
Well, the authority as currently written in the statute, it sort of leans on the possibility that we'd work with the Coast Guard and use their resources and their abilities to go on and do this type of sampling. What we've found is that the Coast Guard is extremely overtasked, in my opinion personally, in terms of the different things they're supposed to check when they're doing their inspections. And we found that their inspections of ballast water are very low on their priority list. And so we don't feel like they're doing a very concentrated or focused job in terms of looking at this particular problem. That's why we feel like it's important to have a state presence on the vessels. So with respect to the resources available to our agency to do this and to take this on, indeed, my plate of different activities is fairly broad, but right now I'm trying to dedicate about 15 or 20% of my time to going on vessels to do inspections. That's not a very high percentage of the vessels that come into our port, but it's something, and the feedback has been positive in the last year and a half since I've been in the position about our presence on the vessels. So
we'll follow up, Madam Chair. And we as I I mean, we as multiple, so there's only one. So
I have support from other people in the department as well.
And that's what I'm trying to figure out here. Under definitions, waters of the state means natural waterways, including tidal, non-tidal, intermittent streams, constantly flowing streams, wetlands, bodies of water in the state, navigable, non-navigable, including portions of the Pacific Ocean.
When
you're trying, it's everything that's got water on it in the state, basically. So, I mean, you say 10 to 15% of your time. You're going up to the Port of Portland, or you're going to the Port of Coos Bay? I mean, what's the plan of attack, or what's the long-term goal here of what you're anticipating?
Madam Chair, Senator Boyquist, I monitor daily the vessels that come into our ports. That includes all the ports along the Columbia, including Coos Bay. We receive about 150 arrivals per month on the Columbia, and about 100 of those are actually at Oregon ports, and then maybe 4 arrivals in Coos Bay. For particularly high-risk vessels, or those ones that I try to prioritize based upon risk assessment, but I will go to the Port of Portland, just like you said, to the individual ports. We're not actually going out on the waters trying to. We don't have a vessel to go and try to board the vessels. So we wait for them to come in, and then the inspection that we do is based upon record book audits, making sure that what they've reported to the state, which is a requirement that they report to us 24 hours in advance, what their ballasting operations are going to be, to make sure that their record books conform with that, and then if necessary, take ballast water samples to verify.
Okay. Well, I'm good, Madam Chair.
Okay. Other questions? All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen. We have a few more people would like to testify.
Thank you.
And thank you for information. We have Mark Sitzma and Tom Wolf. And you had signed up for both bills, so... How about it? Mark, why don't we let you go this time?
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Mark Sitzma. I was a member of the Oregon Ballast Water Task Force since 2001, and I chaired it for the first 6 years of its existence. So I've been involved in ballast water for a long time and helping get the program going in the state. And although we only have one FTE at DEQ, that's one FTE more than we had 3 years ago. So we're making progress, I think, in that regard. I'm supportive of these bills, both of the bills. I think it's important to keep the state sort of up to speed on ballast water management. We have neighboring states that are much more aggressive in sort of pursuing regulations. And in my opinion, Oregon has been very patient with the shipping industry and with the Coast Guard in terms of developing standards and regulations. Since 2001, the emphasis has been in this state that we're supportive of a federal program that would be across all the states, as long as it's supportive of or protective of Oregon waterways. And to this date, the Coast Guard still has not developed ballast water discharge standards for ships to comply with. Our neighboring states are doing that. I think it's time that Oregon moves forward on that and sort of joins our neighboring states in developing common standards or as uniform standards as possible, because I think it's critical to protect our water resources. So with that, I'll stop and answer any questions that I might.
Well, just to follow up on that, Mark, so there are no federal ballast water discharge standards?
Not at this point.
And those are under development?
They've been under development for many years, and they're not. They haven't been published
okay,
yet.
Okay, then. All right. Senator Boyquist, do you want to wait until after...
Either way.
Why don't you go ahead?
Madam, just to clarify, I mean, in previous testimony elsewhere, I think said the Law of Sea Treaty hasn't been adopted in the United States, but I think there is pretty much, there's a set of international standards we ought to be directing, and I'm just kind of trying to get some assurances here that the group you work with is, you know, looking at adopting that set of international standards so that there's some uniformity between, in the future, between the Port of Singapore and the Port of Portland or the Port of Coos Bay?
Madam Chair, Senator Boyquist, I think the U.S. government is working towards standards or ballast water management programs. Whether or not they'll be uniform internationally, I don't know. That's up to the U.S. Senate. They sign the treaties. I think the standards and the program that the U.S. will have will be more stringent than IMO guidelines. That's what I think will happen. I'm not on any of those committees, so I don't know, but from my understanding, that's the discussion that's going on. But the key thing here is that we'll have uniform standards nationwide. That's really the goal of everybody. So when a ship comes in, they don't have to deal with differing standards in California and Oregon and Washington. It'll simplify compliance that way.
Follow-up, Manager.
Follow-up.
But I guess my point is, in the interim, we're taking action because the feds are slow as
mm-hmm.
usual. And I'm just trying to make sure that whatever we're adopting is at least somewhere in the ballpark of what everybody else is expecting.
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, I think the states are leading on this. The federal government is really lagging behind. So I think the goal on the West Coast all along has been consistent standards, so that it's, at least on the West Coast, we're uniform.
Right, okay.
And we have meetings every year, several meetings a year, to sort of bring everybody together. All the states come together. All the scientists that work on ballast water management come together, and we talk about how we make a uniform program that's effective and protective, but still that the industry is able to comply with. And I can't speak for the industry, but I think that they're at the table when we're having those discussions, and I think they're supportive of this effort as we go forward.
Great. Tom?
Chair Dingenfelder, committee members, I'll make this very quick. I'm Tom Wolk with the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. We support both House Bill 2714 and 2625. We were talking earlier about the zebra mussels and quagga mussels getting into the state. The reason they're in this country in the first place is because they came out of ballast water. So any bills that help clarify and continue Oregon's attempt to deal with ballast water are great things. So we think that both these bills should be passed and urge you to do so. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Any other questions for the panel? All right, thank you very much. Yeah, that's it. Anybody else that would like to testify on either of these bills? Okay, well, with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2714A and close the public hearing on House Bill 2625. We'll open up a work session on House Bill 2714A. Oops. Now, one moment. There you go. I'm sure you can do this without it, too.
Madam Chair, I'd move House Bill 2714A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Atkinson moves House Bill 2714A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the motion carries. And Senator Haas, would you like to carry this bill?
2714A.
Yes. I think it's been a while, and it'd be great. Okay, with that, we will close the work session on House Bill 2714A, open up a work session on House Bill 2625.
I'm sure I'd move House Bill 2625 forward to pass recommendation.
Senator Atkinson moves House Bill 2625 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Senator Boquist.
Yeah, Madam Chair, just for the record, I mean, the Law of Sea treaty, which we have not signed on to, for whatever reason, the U.S. Senate has pointed out, and the scientists behind that, they set a series of standards. I just want to be on the record that whatever standards we're setting, that we're trying to at least replicate what we anticipate the Law of Sea treaty would have, so that we are standardized, at least, as they pointed out, along the West Coast and with potential other nations in the future, so that we don't get completely out of the box and we keep that into consideration. But I'll be supportive of the bill.
Okay, great. Well, thank you for those comments. So noted. Any other discussion? Okay, any objections? Seeing none, motion carries, and House Bill 2625 will go to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Boquist, would you like to carry this?
Oh, delighted, Madam Chair. I'd like to talk about the Sea Law Treaty again.
Okay, with that, we will close the work session on House Bill 2625 and open up our last public hearing, which is on House Bill 2080. And Beth, if you can say a few words, and then I will as well.
Madam Chair and committee members, in front of you, I have House Bill 2080A. Just for the record, there is no revenue, and there was a fiscal statement issued on the bill. It encourages appropriate reuse of gray water for beneficial uses, defines gray water as wastewater from baths, showers, bathroom, and kitchen sinks and laundries, directs the Environmental Quality Commission to adopt rules for gray water reuse and disposal system permits, declares an emergency, and is effective upon passage, and there was additional written testimony that's been provided to you.
Okay, thank you, Beth. And colleagues, you probably noticed that the bill was actually pre-session filed at the request of the House Interim Committee on Energy and Environment, which was my committee. So this bill originated in my House committee last session. For 7 years, I've worked on the water reuse issue. We started with effluent or water that was being treated, wastewater that was being treated and applied on fields, and then we moved on to looking at gray water within buildings. So this bill focused on allowing the use of gray water or reclaimed water within a building or on a yard. And so you'll hear more about that. But this was sort of the second part of the water reuse task force discussion. So here we are 7 years later, and it's coming now to fruition.
Lucky seven.
Yes, and so there's been a lot of work put into this already. We had a work group for 6 months during the interim. We have some members of the work group here to talk about this, and we also, I think, have the department that was also involved in that. So I don't see Neil here. I see is Christine?
I'm going to run next door and go grab one. We can go in the other
committee. Okay. So we may have to just recess for a couple minutes here while we grab the DQ folks, because we'd like to have them come up. Actually, we'll have some of the members of the committee can come up and talk about this as well. We have Brenna Bell and Russell Romas. While we're waiting for the bureaucrats to come.
Why
25? Because we leave some for the public as well. Even though there's only five of us, we'd like to have copies for everyone else. So why don't you get started?
Sure.
And identify yourself for the record, please.
Sure. My name is Brenna Bell, and I'm a volunteer with Try On Life Community Farms Recode Project, and I've also worked with Willamette Riverkeeper on this bill. And as Senator Dingfelder said, this has been a long process, an exciting process, a very, very public, integrated process. I'm not going to go over my written testimony, as you can read that on your own, but I will note that last year we had a public forum that called together about 40 different people representing government agencies, industry, the building industry, architects, engineers, environmental groups, landscapers, all to talk about what the accessible, safe reuse of gray water for exterior uses would look like. And that really launched a very integrated public campaign to get the bill to where it is now before you, which is very exciting. I think we're in a time when it's very important to be looking at our resources because we don't have a lot of new ones. So we have to look at what we're using and see how we can be using it better. And water is one of those key issues. And currently, we are flushing away, draining away a lot of usable water every day while we're importing potable water and using it for irrigation on our lawns. Savings from this bill would be enormous. It'd be about 35 to 40 gallons per person per day of water that could be saved if we could be using our bathwater, our showers for irrigation. And in the summer, domestic water use doubles by about 50% at the same time that our water resources decrease. And that leads to higher energy water and probably increasingly unavailable summer water as we're losing our snowpacks. So if we can make it so that we can use our existing water more wisely and have to stop finding so many new water resources, I think it would be a real benefit to the people and the waters of Oregon. As I said before, this is a very public process. On the backside of the testimony is a list of endorsers for this bill. And it kind of runs the gamut from sustainability education centers to architectural firms to engineers to green building councils to large environmental groups. And there is a broad swath of people who are supporting it, and I encourage you to do so as well.
Thank you. Why don't you go ahead and we'll take questions.
Hi there. My name is Russ Romas, and I'm a member of the board of Oregon Sustainable Agriculture Land Trust, as well as a sustainable technologist. And I'm pretty excited about this because of a couple possibilities that this opens up. And I agree with everything that was just said, and I'll throw a couple other things in as well. One is the what we're doing here is inventing a new green business. This is going to put people to work that are going to need to specialize in setting up the piping and the mulch basins and what kind of plants to plant in the place where this Gray water's exiting people's homes. And this is all stuff that could also be programs could be created at local community colleges or universities to train people on how to do this stuff and do it well and do it in a way that not only saves water, but also increases our food security and gives people opportunities to have more food, less water use at their home. So to localize and get this as close as possible, what we're talking about is running a pipe of relatively clean water out of your house and into an oasis, potentially, of, you know, a fruit tree, a berry bush, this kind of stuff right there. And, you know, beautiful, useful, edible. I don't see how we lose on that. So thank you. And hopeful that this is going to just be wonderful for the people of Oregon and also lead the way as other states follow suit around the country. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Any questions? All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. And I see that Neil and I know Christine, do you want to come up? I gave the background already about the water reuse task force and a little history on this bill. So if you could jump in there, that would be helpful. And to also talk about the work that was possibly done on the House side.
Okay, thank you. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Neil Mullane. I'm the administrator of the Water Quality Program for DEQ. And with me is Christina Spekovich, our policy analyst for the Water Program. And we're here today to talk a little bit about HB 2080A. And just to run down really quickly, what the bill does is it helps us define what gray water is and is not. It also legalizes the use of gray water outside the home in communities that are connected to community wastewater treatment systems. Currently, the statutes prohibit that use. It also establishes that a person cannot construct, install, or operate a gray water system without a permit from DEQ. And then finally, it directs DEQ to adopt rules, that is, the EQC to adopt rules for gray water use. And if this bill passes, the department would redirect some of its current staff resources into actually putting together a committee and using the committee to put together the rules and the permits that we would use in this program. One thing that I'd like to point out is that if you would turn to Section 3, Sub 7, Sub B, there's just one thing that we'd like to draw your attention to in terms of the definition of what gray water is not. And we've had a lot of discussions on this, and what we're trying to do is make sure that through this definition that we have here for what gray water is not, that we in fact are not limiting the entire program. And currently the definition there says that gray water does not mean toilet or garbage waste or wastewater contaminated by soiled diapers. And our concern here is that if at the front end you would limit the definition of gray water as not waste streams that may be contaminated by soil diapers or, in fact, fecal matter, that would be significantly limit the gray water sources that we could use in this program. And consequently, we have a suggestion for wording there, and I'm not sure if the chair also might have some wording here. But we suggested that if you look at sub B and after the word by, you would include the wording fecal bacteria that exceeds state water quality limits. And the purpose of doing this would be to allow the permit process to specifically identify what the limits are in terms of the fecal bacteria counts that would be in water that would be used in the gray water systems, that is, discharged by those systems. I think the concern here is that the gray water systems would not discharge water that would be harmful to the public health. And what we want to do is very specifically prescribe in the permit process and the rule process what those levels would be and therefore be protective of human health.
Thank you. And we had a lot of discussion about this in the work group, by the way, and Department of Public Health at Department of Human Services was involved, and have they looked at this definition, do you know?
I can't speak to that. I don't know.
So we'll make sure and run it by them, because I know they were very involved in the work group, and I want to make sure.
Yep.
And this would be deleting soil diapers, correct?
That's correct.
Chair Dingfelder, for the record, my name is Christine Svetkovich with the Department of Environmental Quality. Just to clarify, correct, it is correct that the Department of Human Services has not seen this specific language, but we have already talked to them about being on the advisory committee if the bill does pass. Thus, they would be bringing those issues up at that time. So
you can check with them as well, though. I just want to make sure, because they were very involved in the drafting of, in the work group and drafting in the legislation originally. So any questions for the department? Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Put your practical hat on, if you would, please. We're talking presently under Oregon law, if you have a take a rural house with a septic system that's designed in the last 10 years, you can't use the gray water. It goes down through the septic system, it goes out into the drain field. And I was trying to skim through the architectural letters that we'd see where they had testimony on the far side. I mean, are we talking about getting a permit to, for better word, a building permit to replumb the house so they go into separate systems and then we can recycle after some sort of treatment the gray water that would come out of dishwater, so on and so forth? So, I mean, what's the practical end of how we would do this?
Certainly.
It's a great idea. I think it's a great idea.
Yeah.
But what's the practical?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator, that's exactly what this program would do, is we're trying to basically change the statute so that we are allowed to do exactly what you described. That is, allow architects to design within the buildings two systems, that is collecting black waste mm-hmm. that would go to the traditional treatment systems, and then to collect gray water and put it through potentially another type of treatment system, and then utilize that outside the structure. And in some cases, utilize it within the structure for, say, for example, flushing water and urinals. And we have in Portland, we already have permitted that type of use and put together the permit which would allow people to basically separate their systems and use it within the structure for urinal waste. But what we need to have is a change in the statute so that we can, in fact, use it outside the structures and use it within, you know, in the yards and that type of thing, with proper treatment and the proper permits.
So follow up. Is there any testimony? I mean, and I don't have it, but I have most of the house documentation mm-hmm. here. But is there any practical, as architects and engineers come up with a practical way to go into like a septic system now after the discharge on the other side and do treatment, or do we have to capture it before it's coming down? I'm trying to, this is future, but obviously we have, you know, tens of thousands of existing septic systems and houses out there. I mean,
again, Chair and Senator, what we would anticipate is that people would capture it before it would go into the septic system,
okay.
and then utilize it at that point, so that you're not going through the septic system and then separating some water out and using it for this use. But you would identify those gray water streams within the structure, plumb it within the home, and then utilize that water outside the home, outside of the septic system.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
Is there any cost analysis? Because I understand what you're saying. You could pretty easily, any place with a crawl space, a house with a crawl space, you could identify, you know, bathtubs in certain places where you could capture that water now. Are there systems? Is it a charcoal filter system? I mean, what do we envision doing with the gray water to be able to use it on the lawn outside?
Chair Dingfelder, that's exactly what we want to do with the advisory committee, is we want to list out those particular, say, package systems that would be out there today that we could utilize for those types of treatment systems in the home and utilize this wastewater.
Final question, Madam Chair. So basically what we do is, you know, and we say the permitting process, we're going to do almost like we're doing a septic tank, where you have to get a DEQ approval now, and that's kind of where you're going to get that permit in the rural area right there, just as if exactly like you would file with DEQ for a septic and say, I want to do a traditional septic and a gray water system, and that's where we're kind of plugging the rural portion of the permitting system in.
Yes, but in one additional sense is that we are hoping to explore the concept of a general permit that would apply statewide, so that people would apply to just for that general permit. It wouldn't be an individual permit for each household.
One more question, I guess, Madam Chair. Time frame?
Follow up.
Again, Chair, Senator, we're putting in a time frame of probably at least 18 months to develop those rules and that permit.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Excellent question, Senator. All of these issues came up in the work group, and I will tell you that, first of all, several other states have done this, so we're going to be looking at, are you sure you weren't listening in? Several other states have done this, so certainly we have directed DEQ to not reinvent the wheel, but to look at what other states have done, because this is not California, Arizona, New Mexico, Washington have all adopted this, and New Mexico, which you know doesn't have, I mean, a lot of these states don't have a lot of new water, so they are recycling their water to the nth degree. So there is already the information out there, so hopefully it won't take as long as 18 months, but certainly I think we also want to make sure it's not onerous for individual landowners, as we talked about that. And right now it's prohibited.
That is correct.
Madam Chair.
Senator.
Thank you. Have people been looking at what this actually does to plants and does it work? I know laundry water has phosphates and things like that, and I have a large...
You won't have high phosphate
now. Fewer phosphates. I have a large lawn, a big sprinkler system, and this seems like a great idea, but I wouldn't want the lawn to be, you know, hydrated and then turn yellow. And so, I mean, what kind of study has been...
Ring around the lawn.
You know, we talked about Barrett. Would this actually
work?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Haas. This is a technology that has been studied tremendously around the country, and in fact, the department has an extensive set of rules that cover the use of treated effluent and use on all various types of golf courses, crops, and that type of thing. And this is really taking that, say, all that study and shrinking it down to what you would do in, say, in an individual home and where we'd use it on lawns and various crops in a home setting. And we do have the use of that particular research that has been done nationally and in Oregon, and to inform us when we put those rules together.
Follow up.
Is this primarily for residential or commercial or both? Or, you know, we've got the big office towers in Portland. Would they, or new buildings, large buildings?
This is primarily for both. I think, however, in the bigger structure, the bigger buildings, they're looking at recirculating it within the building for uses like urinal flushing water, and not necessarily as much outside, because they create more wastewater in the building than they would need to have for irrigating lawns.
And I will note that the plumbing codes were also adjusted, which did not need statute, but that was done through by the plumbing board, and that was just about 6 months ago.
That is correct.
Yes, so it's been a coordinated effort, which I'm very happy about. It's taken several years, but we're finally getting there. So appreciate the work of the department.
Okay.
Thank you. Any other questions for the department before we release them? Thank you, and I'll have you work with Beth on the amendment.
Okay,
and finally, Dan Eisenbeis, stand back there, hiding. And Kenny Bikart, would you like to come up? You can sit together. He doesn't bite.
Never know.
But you have to move those. Move that microphone away. Why don't you go ahead, Dan?
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, Daniel Eisenbeis, League of Oregon Cities. Thank you for the opportunity to provide comments today on House Bill 2080A. We were also involved in the work group on the House side. We represent all 242 cities in Oregon, the vast majority of which provide public water supplies or wastewater treatment to city residents. As such, we have a vested interest in this. In short, we support the bill as currently constructed and are taking a close look at the hand-engrossed amendments from DEQ. Oregon cities are strong stewards of public water supplies, and as I said, they provide clean water for drinking, industrial, and irrigation purposes, as well as management of stormwater and wastewater, and many cities have made extensive investments in water conservation and reuse and continue to do so. We see this as a complementary strategy to much of the work that's already being conducted in cities. That said, we believe that this needs to be done very carefully. Gray water or wastewater generally can become contaminated with bacteria, pollutants of other sorts, and as such cause health hazards, degrade soil and water quality, or attract vermin and other pests. And I think coming out of the work group on the House side, in terms of the sort of performance standards for rulemaking by DEQ and permitting standards, standards. There was a very explicit attempt to make sure that any sort of permitting standards ensure the protection of public health and safety, welfare, public water supplies via cross connections, and generally speaking, the waters of the state. Looking at the definition of gray water and what gray water does not include, I think there's pretty common agreement that gray water should not be construed to include human feces. But I know the department has concerns that there may be trace amounts of fecal matter and various sorts of wastewater, and we appreciate that point. If the committee does decide to pursue the direction of the suggested amendment language from DEQ, we'd suggest that in addition to fecal bacteria, that the amendment language also include other pollutants as something that should not exceed state water quality limits, so that we're being very clear that the department should be considering a full range of pollutants in their rulemaking process. And lastly, I would just note that from our perspective, it's very important that practitioners from the water supply and wastewater treatment arenas be involved in the advisory committee that's helping inform that effort. Thank you for the opportunity to comment, and I'd welcome any questions.
Thank you, and thanks for your input on the House side on this. And Mr. Bikert, you get the last word, and you came all the way from Madras, so we appreciate you coming here today.
Thank you, Senator Dingfelder. I do appreciate the time allotted here, you're right, I did come over from Madras, and I thought I had a wealth of information for you, and it seems like I've walked right into the middle of the movie. You people have done a lot of study that I was not aware of and in regards to that. And certainly our annual rainfall at the Madras airport is about 10 inches a year, and two of which came last week. And so we're short on water, and I've been involved in agriculture for years, as well as shoving water around in various forms, mostly with agriculture. But we have been pretty much instrumental in trying to come up with new methods to conserve water in our farming operations, be it surface and mountain runoff, mainly in the Madras area. We have pump back systems, which we gather the water, the runoff water at the end of the field, and we run it back around and again until we get all the wet out of it. We're using some trickle irrigation in Central Oregon now on various crops. Working pretty well. It's not cheap, but it's working quite well. We have more efficient sprinkler nozzles that we use on the center pivots and the wheel lines and things like that. We're working pretty close to coming into a zero-point runoff situation where none of the water comes off of that irrigation project in North Unit Irrigation District and the others that'll go back into the Deschutes River or anything like that. We're not there yet. We reuse the wastewater from the confined animal operations. People are becoming more concerned about that when we have rain and things that washes those things, the effluents off into town, et cetera, et cetera. We've used upstream water impoundments. For us old farmers, that's a dam, a little dam's up above to catch the water and control it if we can. We've installed rain guzzlers for the wildlife. We've spent millions of dollars on the lining and piping of our canals in Central Oregon. Due to the water evaporation, our irrigation water comes for 100 miles. So, and there's about 50% of it that never makes it, because of evaporation and seepage, etc. We have our sewer system in Madras. We catch that water and treat it, and that goes back into irrigation. The solids are collected, and they're also used for crops that we don't directly consume, like in wheat crops and things like that. We can use them. Our water levels in the wells are going down. I state. We work in the irrigation business. We cover from central Oregon, which is all surface water, to Burns and off into western Idaho. And all of the wells there, most of them are going down. And so we're trying to conserve that water as best we can, both the agricultural wells and the domestic wells. The found out a night or two ago that we've got some gray water capturing facilities there that people have that are really not legal. And we'd like to make them legal for not only for irrigation purposes, but especially in our area in Deschutes County and Jefferson and that part of Central Oregon for fire protection, where we can catch that water and treat it and use it for fire protection when the time arises, or like what we've been stated here as far as lawns and trees and things like that would kind of expand out the zone that we would try to protect from our structures. The technology for the treatment is here, and Senator Dingfelder, you took the wind out of my sails when you rattled off about all these other states. I didn't know that we knew that here in Oregon, especially off in the eastern part here where we're kind of forgotten about, but you are right that we're not the first state that's involved. Nevada and Arizona, some of those other states, it's been illegal for years to use any fresh water in golf courses and things like that. And this problem, I listen to the DEQ people here and whatnot, it's certainly not confined to Central Oregon, where we're looking for a little bit of water for fire protection and whatnot. And the city of Portland, for instance, is talking about using a zero-point runoff for town people, so they'd have to collect their rainwater and keep all the water so it wouldn't run off into the streets and anything. It's a problem. We don't have enough water in Central Oregon, and Portland has too much. But the common denominator, basically, is that we need to capture and reuse of these resources if at all possible.
Well, thank you. And can you just, for the record, repeat your name for folks who are listening online, because I forgot to ask you that at the beginning.
Okay, my name again is Kenny, and the last name is Bicart, and you got that right. Live in Madras, Oregon. We do have a website there. One of them is flame-out.biz.
Okay. Well, thank you for coming here and sharing your support for this bill. We certainly appreciate hearing your real-life experiences, and I will tell you that actually in the summer, believe it or not, in Portland, we don't always have enough water. We actually get some of our drinking water from groundwater wells that are pumping out by the Columbia River, and we have, I actually utilize rainwater to, which is legal, by the way, to collect rainwater to irrigate my garden just about year-round. Mm-hmm. But certainly appreciate you coming all the way here to share your experiences with us and support for this bill. Any questions for either of the witnesses?
Well, Madam Chair, just not to be out, I capture every single drop of rain that hits a roof on every one of my ranches and facilities.
Good for you.
The other thing to Senator Haas was raising on that, we have several companies in Oregon that actually sell the technologies to the federal government and to other states to do this, but it's not legal in Oregon. And as a conflict of interest, I'm an owner of one of those companies.
Okay, so noted for the record, and certainly we hope with this bill it will no longer be illegal. So thank you both gentlemen for your testimony today. And with that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2080 and close the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. Be prepared for a long hearing, possibly on Thursday. So don't make any dinner.